Welcome to the Deep End by On Deck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozloff. Let's dive in.
And so if you're an adult on the internet right now, it's relatively easy for you to find kind of your tribe. You go on Twitter, you go Discord channels, Telegram channels. You can find your people. For kids, it's much harder. There's basically no real space for kids on the internet. Everything is designed for older people, not older, for adults. And then kids are basically stuck kind of just playing Minecraft or Roblox, and that's their community. And so one piece of the internet native education system, I think, is this idea that it should be very easy for you to find your tribe. No matter what you're interested in, no matter what niche thing you're into, you should be able to go very deep with other people who also care about going deep on it.
Deep End, we're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in depth into ideas that inspire people to build. I'll be your guide as we explore possible features of internet communities, creator tools, climate tech, longevity, and much, much more. There are no experts in uncharted territory, only pioneers. The Deep End invites these trailblazers to turn their experiences into the knowledge and ideas that others need to start their own founder odysseys. Joining me this week in the Deep End are the co-founders of Primer, Ryan Dauk and Maxim Stefanenko. They met through On Deck and are currently building a community for curious and ambitious kids to find and explore their interests together. Education is deeply personal, and so our conversation begins on a personal note, with a discussion of Ryan's background growing up homeschooled and Maxim's experience of highly structured curriculum back in Kyrgyzstan. Both of them look at their own learning experience and lament an educational system designed with the assumption that all children should move at the same pace. Kids' talents and interests vary widely. Ryan and Maxim came to the realization with Primer that they could build educational treadmills for kids to run as fast or as slow as they would like towards their particular interests. Our conversation centers on how to augment the education system to create more Michelangelos and Albert Einsteins. How might we enable self-guided homeschooling without total involvement from parents? How can we leverage the dynamics of popularity to make learning cool? The kids that Ryan and Maxim are working with so far are incredible. They have a huge sense of ownership of their online community and are naturally creating governance protocols that limit toxicity and bullying. They're making friends and collaborating on projects, all while learning at a clip that outpaces traditional K-12 school. Ryan, Maxim, welcome to the Deep End.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
I want to start off with a quote at the top of your announcement about Primer, because it really sets the stage for what we're going to talk about today, but also the space that you two are building in. It's from Alan Kay from A Personal Computer for Children of All Ages back in the 1970s, where some people measure progress in answers right per test or test passed per year. We are more interested in Sistine Chapel per ceilings, Sistine Chapel ceilings per lifetime. Either you could pick this up first, we could just switch back and forth. Why did you choose that quote to really start off the announcement of the company? And what does it reflect about what you're building?
You should take this, Maxim.
The core premise behind Primer is that the traditional education system is not really serving certain kinds of individuals, projects, whatever you want to call it. And so the reason this quote is important is because it reminds us to focus on the big picture. Let's produce more like Michelangelos, Leonardos. Let's produce more of the outliers. And so I think that's the big one. Everything else, kind of like the entire education system, is focused on legible metrics like test passed, scores, whatever else gets you into a university. And that's for a reason. But there is, I think there's just a lot of space for the different kind of education system that focuses on like the bigger things, focuses on the outliers.
How about you, Ryan?
Yeah, I think so. Maxim was actually was the driver of, I think, specifically that essay. And its importance in Primer. The thing that really resonates with me about it is there's a certain weightiness and length to an obsession that's required with doing work like the Sistine Chapel or many other similar accomplishments in history. It's, you know, years or in some cases decades. And I think that one thing that we get really excited about is seeing kids devote an abnormal sort of what the world would consider to be a abnormally high amount of time or effort over an abnormally long period working on something. And we've consistently been blown away by what kids create and what they do when that's true. But there's not a lot of space for that to happen in the traditional education system and even just in our culture in general. And so it's everything Maxim said. And I think also just this creating the space and the opportunity for kids to go really deep on things for very long periods of time, working very hard, working long hours on them because they love it and they're obsessed with it. And then sort of seeing what genius and beautiful things come from that.
What's interesting about the two of you here together, and I'm glad we arranged it that way, is Maxim, you're from
Kurdistan,
which means that when we're saying traditional educational system, our listeners likely have a vision of that. But when you're talking about the traditional educational system, could you talk about the system that you came from? And then Ryan, as someone who is homeschooled through eighth grade, talk about the system that, as you're perceiving it.
Yeah, so the kind of the environment I come from, it's a post-Soviet country. So it used to be part of the Soviet Union, very strong emphasis on math, science, but also a very strong emphasis on just like memorization and like that kind of stuff, and less emphasis on creativity and kind of like individualistic pursuits compared to the US system. But otherwise, like well, one thing that is like interesting, that homeschooling is actually illegal where I'm from. And so everyone is required to go to school. And there is very little like what you can choose. You kind of just have the curriculum. The entire like 11, and it's 11 grades, 11 grades is predetermined for you. In the US, as far as I know, you can like at least in some areas pick what you specialize in or what you prefer to focus on. In Kyrgyzstan, it was very much like the entire 11 years already specced out for you. And so and we'll get into this later, but I got really lucky and I just got to skip high school and focus on something that was interesting. And that was a big inspiration for Primer.
And Ryan, as you were looking at the traditional system in the US, as someone who, as I take it, went to high school in the traditional system, how do you perceive the US educational system?
Yeah, it was interesting. So my parents, the big difference for me was my parents were very oriented, I think, around a different time horizon for education and thinking about the success of education. So my mom was a public school teacher. She actually wrote her like graduate thesis on why homeschooling should be illegal and why it was a terrible form of education. And then we moved to Florida. She took me to kindergarten orientation. We were in a I think, pretty bad school district, and she just like, I can't leave you here. And so she ended up homeschooling me and my two siblings for 16 years, all kindergarten through eighth grade. And there's a lot of things we can talk about and dive in there. But I think the sort of the singular thing that I would point to is that my parents were not optimizing for what exact reading level we would be at age 9 years old and 6 months. They were optimizing for at age 29, would we be the types of humans who loved reading and who knew how to think for ourselves and who were articulate and who, you know, were bold and ambitious and creative and those things. So it was just a very different framing and a very different time horizon. And I think that was, you can trace everything back that was unique about my education experience to that perspective that they had. And unfortunately, in the traditional education system, I think it's very difficult to offer that because there is this sort of, if you're going to educate, you know, tens of millions of kids a year, you have to create a high degree of legibility, and you have to be able to standardize a lot of things, and you have to be able to judge success and failure based on something. And so, you know, I actually don't my views on the education system are complicated because I think if you told me, hey, you need to design a traditional education system that's going to deliver the exact same product or largely the same product to educate tens of millions of kids across 50 states, like I don't know that you could design something that's substantially better at that scale with a sort of homogeneous experience for all those kids. What we believe and what I believe is the whole point is you can't design a homogeneous experience for all those kids. And so I think for me, and I was lucky even at the high school that I went to have a lot of space to explore things and have a lot of classes that were discussion oriented and So I think for me, like it's really about what periods of legibility are we optimizing for? And, you know, 18 years is only, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30% of someone's life, depending on how long they live. And, you know, it's optimizing for the sort of intermediary periods of legibility so that the system understands how your kid is tracking, I think is often the wrong way to approach that. And so I think there's an opportunity here to give kids more space, more freedom to dig into things they're really excited about and think on a much longer time horizon.
What I love about the copy on y'all's explanation for the company, which by the way, I actually really enjoyed reading. This is actually very well done. Thanks. It speaks to the broader ideas that I want to get into here, but it specifically says you're working to free the next generation of kids to be more ambitious, to creative, to think for themselves, starting with homeschoolers. So we'll get into homeschooling in a second, but the starting with homeschoolers phrasing suggests that there's a level beyond just focusing on homeschooling. So could you speak to that longer term vision of how you think this actually operates?
Yeah. So we kind of already are in that. So we started the company very focused on homeschooling initially, and we sort of quickly found, especially for the last like 6 to 9 months, that a lot of non-homeschoolers were signing up, particularly kids that were in the traditional public school system, but their parents, as a product of COVID, they had a very high degree of sort of legibility and understanding of what their kid's education experience was like and realized, hey, this is not enough. Like, this is not cutting it. And so they sought out Primer as a place for their kids to go deeper on things they were interested in, find other kids around the world they could collaborate with, et cetera. And so we've definitely expanded beyond homeschooling now. I think for us, homeschooling is really interesting because it's already people that have sort of opted out of the system. And so by definition, they are thinking on different time horizons and different ways of allocating time for their kids' education, different standards for how they think about their kids' success. And so it was a really good starting point for us. And we're still, we have still a lot of homeschoolers on Primer. We continue to welcome a lot of homeschoolers to Primer, but it's been really cool to see how that's expanded beyond homeschooling. And the long-term goal of Primer is not just to create this space that's, you know, we're starting with the sort of current experiences that we have now, but the long-term goal of Primer is really to use that and, you know, without going into too much detail, like use that to create an entirely new education system for the world. And we think that there's an opportunity to create the sort of first internet native education system. And we think that Primer is going to be in the best position to do that. And already we're starting in a very narrow part of that, but eventually can expand quite a bit from here.
So Maxim, speaking of the longer term vision there, another piece of the copy here is describing the educational challenges of the 2050s. We have a system that was put together at the early first half of the 20th century when the goal was getting kids out of factories, off the farm, and actually helping people learn to read, write, arithmetic, all those basic parts. As you look to the future and you think of these words like internet native, how do you think of the next 20 or 30 years from a pure opportunity perspective?
So the first thing to point out, it will be very weird if in 20, 30 years, we still have exactly the same thing. It's like that. I think Peter Thiel talks about this, like how the future will be different. We just don't know what it will look like. And it's pretty, to me, it will be weird if we still are basically doing the exact same thing, just given how far the technology has come. And the idea of building like, maybe not internet native, but more like computer medium native education system or education tooling has been around since the beginning. Alan Kay, I guess, is like one of the pioneers who was like early in all of this. So that's the first point. And I think our thesis on this is that there are certain things that are uniquely enabled by the internet. So one of them, obviously, it's global. So I grew up in the middle of nowhere. And then suddenly in high school, I moved to the capital to participate in physics Olympiads. And what was really important in that is that, one, I didn't have to do high school. I focused fully on just something I really liked, studying physics. And two, I had other kids around me, like I had a community who were all optimizing for studying for Olympiads, who were all passionate about science. And for me, that was such a big shift compared to where I was in a regular school, because suddenly I had peers interested in what I'm doing. And so if you're an adult on the internet right now, it's relatively easy for you to find kind of your tribe. You go on Twitter, you go Discord channels, Telegram channels. You can find your people. For kids, It's much harder. There's basically no real space for kids on the internet. Everything is designed for older people, not older, for adults. And then kids are basically stuck kind of just playing Minecraft or Roblox, and that's their community. And so one piece of the internet native education system, I think, is this idea that it should be very easy for you to find your tribe. No matter what you're interested in, no matter what niche thing you're into, you should be able to go very deep with other people who also care about going deep on it. So that's one piece. The other piece is, what does the computer medium uniquely enable? And there are many things, right? And I think we're still very, very early here, but the whole space of people working on tools for thought very much, I think, applies to the education system as well. Whatever you can, the idea for tools for thought is around like building tools that will enable the kinds of thoughts that were unthinkable before, right? And a really good example of this is math. Like before we had math, before we had certain notation, like we literally could not think certain thoughts as a civilization. And then with computers, what a lot of people are excited about in the tools for thought space is that you can now build tools that basically expand your, so to say, like memory, right? Your RAM. So you can do more things, or you can sort of like think things that you couldn't think before. So if we take that idea and apply this to education, what is possible? I think it's really early, but there are certain, for example, the mnemonic medium is one thing that Andy Matushek and Michael Nielsen are exploring. That's one idea that's like uniquely enabled by computers. Another one is like Figma is an interesting example. What if you could use Figma for education or Figma-like environment? What does that enable? But to bring it back, I think there are lots of things that are being worked on outside of education that actually, if you apply this to education, will have an enormous impact on kids. And I think no one is taking that seriously and like looking into it. And that's kind of like what Primer is focused on right now.
Ryan, I want to build on Maxim's point about it's hard to imagine the next 20 or 30 years looking the same as today, because if you just go back to, once again, the piece that we referenced was written in the 1970s, people have effectively been making that type of prediction around education since the 1950s. It wasn't just the internet. There was early excitement about radio, television. Why do you have to go when you could get the things delivered? Why do you think up until now, obviously, and we'll get into these numbers later, the number of folks who have been homeschooling has been going ever increasing for the past 20 or 30 years, but still at a different level. The system looks relatively similar relative to previous technological advancements. So why do you think that up until now, that vision and model hasn't changed that much despite technological advancements?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I think the internet is at a fundamental level very different than TV, radio, and other mediums that we could talk about, newspapers, et cetera, mostly because it's a two-way medium instead of a one-way medium at a very fundamental level. And so there's a level of interaction that's possible. It's not just a distribution mechanism. It's actually an environment for interaction. But I think aside from that, the thing that I think maybe some people conflate is people talk about this like sort of factory education model, or like the education system was built for the Industrial Revolution. And I think people often mean two different things by that. And one set of people, I think, means that the education system is effectively a factory that is like churning out kids, which in some ways is true. I think in some ways it's not true. The second is that, which I think is true, is that the education system was effectively designed in a way that would ensure that the parents who needed to work could have their kids in some sort of thing that they're occupied in for X number of hours a day that roughly lined up with working hours. So that if both parents needed to work or whatever the arrangement was, that was possible. To me, that's the part that I think is most interesting to come back to, is that the starting point, I would argue a huge part of the starting point was we need kids occupied for 8 hours a day and, you know, at a physical location where they're not with their parents so that they can work. And there's all sorts of benefits. So I'm not saying it's like inherently bad. I just think it's useful to, you know, consider how much of the education system is designed around this necessity of kids being somewhere so their parents can work, and thinking about what the implications of that are. And so to me, the interesting parts about what we can do now is, one, as you mentioned, alternative education is on the rise. And so homeschooling and a lot of other different variations of it are on the rise. And so there is, 25, 30 years ago, homeschooling was basically illegal, or not really illegal, but like sort of everyone understood it to be illegal because there wasn't any Supreme Court decisions on it yet. And so there is this rise in parents being able to opt out of the system. And then in parallel with that, there's a lot more customization happening with charter schools, different models for education that different schools are trying. And so I think that we are at a point where we're, you know, there was like tons and tons of options for education pre the public school system. One rule schoolhouses, like grow up on your farm, have your parents teach you, have a tutor, whatever. And then we had sort of standardized education. And then we're branching back out again now. And there's now becoming a lot more options for education. And so I think the combination of the internet with the power of the internet and the things that Maxim talked about combined with the rise of alternative education, which in some ways are very coupled, I think creates a really unique moment here where parents and families and kids have an opportunity, whether it's for a couple hours a day after school or full time, to be in and operate in sort of a totally different education landscape than what, you know, we would have operated in 30 years ago.
Maxim, I want to get to something that was referenced earlier, which is this idea of our system not serving outliers well. Because something that's really interesting to me, and Ryan, I appreciate the nuance to what you were saying about how the educational system actually serves its purposes in some context well, because there's the idea of the outlier child you're talking about. So that's referring to the Sistine Chapel. That's referring to you leaving school to study physics full time. There's also the talented and gifted kid who's just an overachiever. And, you know, that actually kind of works pretty well for a lot of those kids. Like they're the type of person who goes to a top tier school for college and then goes and works in consulting. They're actually pretty satisfied with the system. So just speak more about these outliers who the two of you are interested in, because that's the type of system where I could easily see, even in the most socioeconomically balanced system, even in the most, you know, your parents have the ability to stay home, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they are going to be underserved. So speak about that from your perspective too.
To Ryan's point, I think the existing school system, just generally the way it got designed and the way it got built, all of that happened for a reason. And it actually serves a pretty, like it serves its purpose. It actually elevates everyone to a certain level. So I think it increases the floors. So in the very least, you have everyone in the society has a certain level of education. What it doesn't do well is remove the ceilings for people who want to go way beyond. And so the outliers we see right now, I think, are there because of chance, luck, or because of like really hard work and perseverance. And that's a huge loss to society. And it's like one of those, like in economics, they say like the $1 trillion bill lying on the sidewalk. I think this is another case of that, where with relatively simple interventions, you can enable many more people to go after bigger things and like do more things. And that's kind of like what we want to do with Primer. One way we describe the company is as an engine to help kids achieve their potential. And I think it's no question that every kid has potential. And this point became much more clear to me as we were working on Primer, just seeing the kind of stuff that kids do, their passion, their excitement about the stuff that they're doing when they are still young, and then seeing like what comes out of high school on average. And there's a crazy delta. And I think what happens in the system right now is that like a lot of the passion, a lot of the education just get completely squashed because, one, you don't really have the time to do things. The expectations are different. You are forced to focus on whatever is legible to the outside world, which are right now test results, college admissions, things like that. And so I think the big opportunity here for alternative education system is actually to free the kids. That's what we say in the memo, free the kids to actually go after whatever they're excited about. And there are obviously like all kinds of things you have to consider when you do that. But it would just increase the level of ambition, the level of achievement in all of the society, and benefit everyone if we just did some like simple things and freed up their time, let them go really far, help them find other people who are interested in it.
One thing that I think is interesting to understand about the and under discussed about the current system is that we're sort of like very lucky that a lot of school teachers just happen to be extremely altruistically motivated and excited about kids' progress, because the system itself is designed around downside minimization, not upside maximization. And so the entire incentive structure, if you're a public school teacher, like if you think about the difference between, let's say, having five kids in your class of 25 that are, you know, three grades ahead in reading and writing and math, and they're just excelling, and they're, you know, you're, and maybe even your whole class is excelling a little bit, but these kids are just, you know, totally like through the roof, versus having, you know, five kids that are failing and they're three grades behind, and you're, you know, your class isn't passing the tests, the standardized tests, or whatever, depending on your state. In one case, in the upside case, you might get a $500 bonus in some districts. You might get a ribbon. You might get a little acknowledgement you could put on your LinkedIn. In the other case, you get fired. And, you know, so for, as a teacher, you have like almost no incentive structure to, besides just being a good human, to push to like help kids sort of, you know, sort of achieve these like go farther, go faster, et cetera. And in some ways, like to Maxim's point, this system has created, you know, sort of raised the floor for everyone and the average level of education, certainly from like a pre-public school world. But I think like the, I don't have like anything, we don't have anything against teachers. Like we're not like anti sort of like public school in the sense that I think a lot of new education and consumer kind of kid companies are. I just think that this incentives are totally messed up. And if you were going to run an experiment, the experiment I would be really interested in is what happens if you like heavily incentivize teachers to, you know, help create these amazing outlier outcomes for kids. And what does that do over a couple of years? And I don't know if it would solve, you know, the majority of problems of the current education system, but I think the fundamental thing is that the incentives are off. And when you think about taking a kid out of that context and into the context of their parents or a small micro school or some other alternative education, or even just after school being on primer, the incentives are totally different. And I think that shift is sort of underappreciated. And I think we all should be very thankful that most teachers happen to just be very motivated and excited by kids' progress, because the system itself is not incentivizing that to happen.
And Ryan, I'll ask this to you first, because you went through the American homeschooling system, and then Maxim, please jump in afterwards. But what is the total addressable market for homeschooling in the year 2021? Because what's interesting is you all started working on this in 2019. So I'm sure that 2.4 million number was bandied about the increasing graph. People are doing it more, but COVID just inevitably made it that the number of people who were at home were looking for alternatives just really expanded. So what would you just say is the state of the at-home learning, either full-time or supplementary education? What does that just look like right now?
Yeah. So two things happen. So one is we don't really think about there was this temporary blip in homeschoolers, like people that were doing school from home during COVID because their school was closed. And it was really like distance learning. We don't really think about that too much, because that's obviously going to revert back to pretty close to the previous numbers. The two things that I think have happened that have increased the addressable market. So depending on like the data source, there was somewhere between like 2 and 3, maybe 4 million homeschoolers before COVID, depending on how you count it. And the interesting thing that I think has happened, and the data is starting to show, is that one, supplemental spending is skyrocketing because parents are realizing that school is not enough, even though their kids are back in school. And so they need to supplement in other ways, because they had this front row seat to their kids' education and they realized, okay, we need to do more here. And the second thing is I think that we will see a step function in alternative education in general. And so there's a lot of numbers coming out. North Carolina just published numbers about homeschoolers, and that was way up, like 50 or 60% year over year, permanent homeschoolers, not like COVID homeschoolers. And so I think that we'll see, you know, this some sort of step function. So if we're, you know, year 2030, we're like looking back on this, I think we'll see this step function from 2019 to 2021 or 2022, and then it'll go back to like 2 or 3% growth. Maybe it'll accelerate. And we think there's things we can do to accelerate it. But I do think there was sort of a permanent shift in the alternative education side. And then another permanent shift that's, I think, even more exciting on how parents think about supplemental education and the way they think about allocating time and money to that in a way that I think has actually been true internationally, especially in Asian countries for a much longer time, that in some ways is now coming to the US. And parents are starting to view, you know, this type of thing as something they would spend money on and spend time on with their kids.
One thing to add to that is the other thing that happened accelerated because of COVID is parents saw their kids being online, and they were kind of like almost forced to allow their kids to be online, and that got normalized during COVID. And so a lot more kids who usually wouldn't be spending time on Roblox or Minecraft or whatever are now there because during COVID, parents basically had no other choice. And now they're pretty comfortable with their kids being online. So one proxy that is interesting is the, I believe, 50 million daily active users on Roblox. Half of them are under 13 years old. And so that number is crazy. And that number has gone up quite a bit during the pandemic. And so that is a big shift that happened as well. That is tailwind for Primer.
So a big question I'll throw to you first, Ryan, is you all have written about the need to make these type of options more mainstream. What would you say right now is the obstacle to mainstream adoption? Because obviously, and we'll get into this in a second, there's the lack of tech stack around bringing infrastructure together. But from my perspective, the obstacles are actually much more cultural in that I'm from a upper middle class town in Oregon. The issue is not that people lack the technology or the access, it's just that it's not seen as the option that they would take. So how do you think you transition? And I'm just throwing the class aspect there because I'm just setting aside for a second the very obvious, hey, like once again, there's a bunch of people who need the current system at a very straightforward level. So once you're moving beyond that and taking that out as an outlier thing in itself, how do you think that transitions to a more mainstream option?
Yeah, it's your question in regards to like parents spending more on supplemental stuff, say after school, or is your question more on the transition to people exiting the current system entirely and homeschooling or microschooling or?
Yeah, I would say the more alternative part then.
There's two things. So one is I think the immovable barrier to homeschooling is right now that it requires someone full time to do it, or more or less full time. If you talk to anyone who two working parents who did distance learning during the pandemic, they will tell you how hard it is to work full time and even work from home full time and try to do any sort of education with your kids. So the immovable barrier, I think, right now is mainly that. And so for most families, if you're a dual income family that needs both incomes, if you're a single parent, there's all sorts of situations where it's just literally impossible. Like you have to send your kid to a traditional school. And in most cities and states, you're in this sort of duopoly, situation where you have a very expensive private school option. Or public school options that you, in many cases, are probably not thrilled about. And so you basically are just stuck with those two options. And so what we're really excited about is, obviously, there's a lot of Primer families that have exited the system and are homeschooling or doing other sort of types of education. But what we're really excited about is how do we use that density, the density of Primer families, to actually start to bootstrap this sort of alternative education system and an infrastructure for families. And so without going into too much detail, there's a lot of interesting things you can do when you get these families who have physical spaces, such as their homes or other locations they can meet, where they can actually start to provide an alternative where even if you are a single parent or a parent, a family that needs two incomes that has kids that you can't, one person can't stay home with them, there's options for you to still get the, frankly, the kid sort of babysitting aspect of school, be going to a physical location for X hours a day, but still being in a very sort of alternative structure where they can explore their interests, do project-based learning, et cetera. And so I think structurally, that's the thing that I'm most excited about that we'll get to in several years. But in the meantime, what I'm interested in and where we think the highest leverage is continuing to empower the families that have done that and build, software experiences and for them, but making things like Primer mainstream in the same way that, Roblox and Fortnite and Minecraft have gone mainstream, where spending time online in a community, exploring your interests, working on ambitious projects. Like the cool thing to do on Primer is not to have like the highest score at some game. The cool thing to do on Primer is to like work really hard on stuff. And that's how you gain status on Primer. It's to be interested in something. It's to geek out on something with other kids. Like those are the high status things to do on Primer. And so if in some ways it's like every kid wants to be cool. Every kid wants to be liked. How do we create an environment where that desire is actually working for them instead of working against them? And so that's a lot of like what we think about in terms of taking it mainstream is how do we, and we're already starting to see this, but how do we get this in sort of like the normal pattern of how families and kids think about spending time online, regardless of whether they're homeschooling or joining Primer after school or on the weekends.
And speaking of which, we focused on the ideas part of this, but Maxim, can you just actually speak to how Primer actually works and what it looks like, especially given Ryan's point about the way to be cool on it?
As it is right now, Primer is a community for 9 to 14 year olds where they get to, basically it's a community that revolves around interests. So we have clubs, we have Game Makers Club, Inventors Club, Artists Club, where kids, based on their interest, if you're interested in game making, you join it. And everything in there revolves around creating games, sharing your projects, giving feedback, receiving feedback from other kids. That's the first part. And the second part that we recently added that's been a big success is synchronous interactions for that. So we have a product called Rooms. Rooms are audio chat systems. And the audio chat is a small part of it where 6 to 10 kids can get together and they do something together. The main component of a room is an area we call Canvas that's powered by almost like a small game engine where kids get to do things like puzzle hunts, mystery hunts, or business simulations together in a collaborative way. Or they can also just like work on a story or a book together. So those are kind of like the building blocks. The big thing that's, I guess, different from a lot of other education places and whatever is that Primer is a place where kids are running these communities. And so a lot of the tools that we initially built for ourselves to run these clubs, to create content for rooms where that kids are, where kids can do something, a lot of these tools are now accessible to kids. And they are the ones who are creating new clubs, creating new communities, creating new content to engage with other kids. So an example is we have a 10-year-old kid who is really into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and he runs a mini club where other kids who are into Marvel Cinematic Universe meet once a week in a room, and he prepares all the content. He prepares trivia quizzes, or they will like go deep on a character. There's another kid who wants to teach others how to program because he just learned how to program, and he thinks it would be much better to learn from someone your age than from an adult. There's a girl who has an artist club. They call themselves the Really, Really Cool People Persons Club, which is, I don't know what that means, but so
that's
they,
the point.
They also meet. Yeah, they meet once a week. She usually prepares a prompt and they all draw together asynchronously, like on paper, on their iPads. And then at the end of the session, they share their drawings in the artist club. Over time, the same group of kids are meeting over time, like multiple for many weeks, and you can see the progress they're making and how their art is improving. But that's Primer on the high level, kind of like the community. And then there's another big piece of Primer, which we think of as the structured learning part of Primer, the product called Pursuits. We have one pursuit out right now called Galactic Explorations Pursuit. And that one is a 6-week long cohort-based experience where kids get into teams of 4 to 6 kids. And for 6 weeks, they work on a mega project, so to say. So in the current batch, they're exploring exoplanets and how to terraform them, how to settle them. They're preparing a business plan. They're pitching their business plan on like how to go there to investors, and kind of just like working together. But this part of Primer, we want to turn into a structured learning environment, because if you go back to the quote about the Sistine Chapel ceilings, if you actually read the paper surrounding that quote, the context is right after, I think he follows with, it's not enough to just want to create Sistine Chapel ceilings. You also need to like spend decades practicing. You need to know the craft. And so something we are spending a lot of time focusing on is actually also creating the space where you can learn the craft, so you can go and with your community like inspire others and like do stuff. And so this is kind of like the vision for the pursuits. Right now we have a single one, but we'll be rolling out more and more.
You know, I just have to ask a quick follow-up that I would like both of your takes on, which is the second you started describing young kids running internet communities, I just kind of blanched, because if we think about it, I don't want to even say received wisdom, because this generally tends to be true, is that internet communities can quickly become toxic or undesirable. So maybe there's a broader lesson here. What have the two of you learned from that experience itself? Because if you were thinking about areas where there's a lot of growth opportunity, when there's actually something that really matters for young kids, how do you all think about lessons from this experience so far?
So it's still very early. So I'll preface this by saying, like, you know, this is something that I think will evolve over time, and our thinking will evolve on over time. We think of there's like sort of two issues here. I think we can talk about the one I think you're getting at, which is sort of the like potential toxicity, bullying dynamics. The other is sort of like safety and how we think about like keeping kids safe in primary communities, which is obviously something that we take extremely seriously. We have a bunch of tools built, a lot of them automatic and just that happen in the background without anyone knowing, that keep kids safe. But on the sort of toxicity bullying side, one of the things that's been really fascinating is I anticipated we would have way more issues than we have on that front. And we have varying theories on why this is. But one of them is that the primer kids themselves actually feel a very high degree of ownership over their respective parts of the primer community and the primer experience. And so we'll see how this plays out over time as we 10x the number of kids and 10x again and see if this is still true. But there's a certain sense of ownership and sort of agency and regulation that happens within the primer kids. Like we've had maybe two or three instances in the last year of real situations where there was, you know, something said that needed a sort of a mediator or to like, you know, loop in the parents. And we have a policy and sort of a system for that. And so I don't know that will be true forever. I'm sure as we get more kids on primer, there'll be more of these situations. But I've been blown away at the way that when you put kids in these environments, that it doesn't feel like this sort of like top-down pressure. It doesn't feel like, hey, you have to do this thing because I said so. You know, I think I'm really interested as we grow the team too and hire more people that have backgrounds more in like child psychology and education psychology to talk about this more with them, because I think there's something unique that happens on primer and that about the community itself and the way the product's architected that is keeping this from happening at the level that we would have expected. And so we'll see how it evolves, but it's definitely something that's very important to us and something that almost every kid comments on at some point is like how positive the primer community is, how supportive they are. And there's a lot of peer feedback that happens where if someone starts to do something that feels like it's not quite within the ethos of that club or the community or whatever, like people will step in and give them feedback, usually in a, you know, sort of relatively kind. I mean, they're, you know, 12-year-olds or 9-year-olds, so they're doing it in the language that they have, but in a relatively kind and straightforward way. And so, yeah, we'll see how it evolves. But so far, at least, it's been really amazing to see them take ownership of that and kind of like sort of self-regulate each other.
Yeah, I'd say one of the big lessons that we've all learned is like we one of the core premises of primer is taking kids seriously. The idea that actually you like kids can and do like do real important work much earlier in life, and the traditional education system kind of just makes them wait until they're 25 or 30 or whatever until they do real important work. And the reality is like they can start much earlier. We started with that premise, the idea take it seriously, and we actually have a neon sign on our wall saying that. And then when the time came to actually act upon it, when the kids started asking us for the tools to basically create their own communities and to create content, we were a little bit hesitant. We're like, oh, we're not sure. Like, we are doing everything right now. For exact the reasons that you kind of maybe alluded to, but we are not sure like how this will play out if we give the tools to the kids to run these communities to create the content. But we decided to try. We gave a few kids the tools, and we were like really blown away. And it just confirmed and replanted this idea of taking kids seriously in our heads. Like if you trust the kids, if you give them the tools, if you give them the support, they really do blow you away. And the core thing to I think emphasize in the taking kids seriously is that also realizing that they're kids, they're very easily impressionable, whatever the word is. And so we also work very hard on like ensuring that we have all the safety tools in place, all kinds of monitoring, all kinds of like policies, and like being very, very thoughtful about how we create the seeds of the community. And so far it's worked well. And like Ryan said, we'll see how it scales. We'll run into challenges, but so far it's working.
Which is very good news. So a couple last bits I want to hit here. So number one, and I alluded to this earlier, Ryan, you wrote about how you were a little shocked at the lack of straightforward infrastructure there was built around these alternate systems of education. Can you just talk about the current state of that market in terms of the disorder and the lack of clearness and where you currently are and where you are looking to actually arrange things?
Yeah. So one of the genesis of Primer, one part of the genesis of Primer was my wife and I started having kids. We live in San Francisco. We started thinking about what their educations were going to look like. In San Francisco, at least, there's very, very expensive private schools. And then there is a public school lottery. And so you actually don't know which, regardless of where you live, you don't know what public school your kid's going to go to until right before the school year. And so I'm not, you know, one that's excited about leaving my child's education up to chance, nor at the time could we have afforded to send, you know, multiple kids to $30,000, $40,000 a year private schools. And so I started looking around to say, okay, what's out there? Like there has to be, you know, I was homeschooled at that point 20 something years ago. Certainly in that time, like my parents were sort of on like the bleeding edge of it. Like there has to be a lot of work that's been done. Certainly there's some sort of infrastructure that's been built for this. And I was looking for two things. Like one, I was looking for ideally someone who'd actually built the sort of internet native, but like physical infrastructure. So like local, you know, micro schools or some sort of alternative education system that was actually physically available locally. And then the second piece was just like places online that my kids could do things that would be sort of a similar ethos to my education growing up, project-based, sort of heavily like what inspires them, based on what inspires them and they're interested in. And I was very shocked and sad on both fronts. There's a few sort of like very niche things in both categories, usually heavily localized in like specific cities or markets or whatever. Some cool stuff happening in Atlanta and a few other cities, but certainly nothing at any real scale. And like there was really no one that I could find that was like even building things that I was really excited about in the space, even after talking to a bunch of different founders and people that were thinking about starting things in the space. And I had this theory that there's like a cluster of problems that like very few startups tackle because there are not that many people that like, in our case, like have kids that are starting companies. Like the sort of prototypical startup founders, like, you know, Stanford grad that's like 21, is like starting a company. And so I think like education is one of those spaces that there's not that many people tackling just as a function of like, it's not a pain point that a lot of people have experienced. And so I was really just sort of like stunned that this didn't exist, and then started thinking about and talking to a bunch of families and like, hey, you know, what would you all want to exist in this space? Like, you know, we're thinking about building something. And so it was like, you know, largely motivated originally by just what do I want to exist for my kids? And then that sort of snowballed into meeting Maxim, and we started jamming on ideas for several months, and then got just really excited about trying to build this both for like, you know, my kids and Maxim's future kids, and also like hopefully millions of other kids as well.
I have to ask you a follow-up because your articulation of why certain areas are undercovered is really smart. And let's give some news you can use for folks who aren't in the education space and are listening. What are other areas where, because of personal and biographical details, you don't feel as if founders are focused on?
I'm trying to think of the companies that I've invested in that I get really excited about this. I think a lot of things to do with small businesses. I backed a founder that was, his parents owned a like small grocery store. And so he learned firsthand like the struggles of running like a small independent grocery, decided to build a company to basically like digitize and build systems and software infrastructure for that market that basically they were all still in 2021 operating on spreadsheets, like Excel files basically to run their businesses. And that company's just exploding because there's not that many startup founders who like worked in a grocery store growing up and are now starting companies and like know that pain point. I'd have to think of other ones, but I think anything that's like not something that the sort of like prototypical startup founder has encountered personally, like most people solve problems that they experience personally. It's why there's so many SaaS companies is that you work at a company, you find something that doesn't work about it, and you're like, oh, I'm going to go build a service to make this easier. And it's a good way to start a business. Like if you have that pain point, other people probably do too. But I think there's these gaps in the market that, you know, that are very underserved. Oh, everything related to, like pregnancy and fertility. And now this market is less underserved in the last like 5 years. But that was a enormous market that just everyone was ignoring because there was so few people that had, you know, either directly struggled with fertility issues or had gone through that experience personally that were starting companies. And so they had no idea how big of a problem this was and how much technology could impact this and improve people's lives. And now there's, you know, multiple billion-dollar companies in the space. So I get really excited, as you can tell, by when people start to like, you know, take these problems seriously and jump in. And I'm always excited to fund and back and meet those teams.
Maxim, what's your answer to that question?
One area that's interesting to me that I think is pretty underappreciated is, and there are more people working on this now, but kind of the idea of these are like international talent. So I invested in one company as well that does this, where there are all these like amazing engineers who live in different countries that would like to work at Google or Facebook or whatever. It would 10x their income if they just moved to the US, but they don't know the culture. They don't know like kind of like what to, how to navigate the interview process and stuff, but they would totally qualify to be an engineer there. And so this is the kind of experience that like not a lot of people here know. And so I have a friend who is working on that. So that's one area. Just, I guess people who live in other countries have very different experiences that is like very foreign to Americans. I think that's very underserved, and that's like improving a lot right now, just because I think startups are exploding everywhere.
Yeah, no, Ryan, I actually may steal that and give this as a question for people on the podcast, because it's an interesting one, especially when people have unique biographies. So the last question I'll ask to both of you, because I don't personally have kids yet, but whether or not I use Primer or any of these different systems, I want to have the type of kid who would want to use Primer, where that would be a good fit for them. Obviously, I would love a kid who could paint the Sistine Chapel. I think most listeners would too. So Ryan, you as, you know, as a father, and then Maxim as someone who's worked with the type of kids who are succeeding in this system, what is your general advice or framework for how those types of kids come about? Because what I could guess is, much like, you know, peaked in high school dad who tries to make his, you know, son the quarterback, you probably can't just say at birth, hey, you're going to just like crush it and you're going to be just like unique and you're an outlier. I swear, don't enjoy public school. I know you can't do that. That's obviously to go in the wrong direction, but what's your two perspective on how you can at least be in a situation where this type of thing would be a good fit for you?
Yeah. So I think based on my experience with my parents and my education, how we're approaching with our kids and Primer, the one thread, and we actually have this as a neon sign literally on our wall of our office, it says take kids seriously. It sounds simple, but I actually think that there's, if you really internalize that and you take your kids seriously, you take their interests seriously, you take their emotions seriously, you take what they get excited about, what they get nervous about seriously, there's really interesting things that happen. And a lot of, specifically, I think American culture around children is this sort of like implicitly pedantic, dumbing things down. It's just, you don't treat them like a tiny human. You treat them like this other thing. I'm not saying treat your kids like adults. That's also not healthy. But I think there's something really interesting that happens when you just think about, like, how do I take this kid seriously? And with our kids, at least, we have just, you know, if they show any interest in anything, my goal is to basically set up like a treadmill for them, you know, an imaginary treadmill that they can run as far and as fast as they want on in that interest. And we have been stunned at what happens when you just sort of irrationally like lean, you know, my kid will ask, you know, my eldest son at one point was like, had a friend that spoke Spanish and asked like, how do you say this in Spanish? And, you know, I told him, and then I bought him a couple books that had like English and Spanish in them. And he asked me to read them to him. And then he said, hey, I want to learn more Spanish. So we got a Spanish, like an online Spanish tutor that was really good at, you know, being a tutor for young kids, and like didn't make him do anything. It was all up to him. If he wanted to, you know, dive in, if he wanted to spend time on it, he could pause at any time. I would ask him, do you want me to schedule another class with Miss Helena? And he would say, yeah, and I'd schedule it. And so I think there's like just these fascinating things that happen when you just irrationally like lean into these moments and what they're excited about. And I, you know, I'm early, like I, you know, I ask me in 10 years if my kids end up being the types of kids that you're describing. But I think there is something that just, you know, and we've seen this with Primer too, like with the kids that when they feel taken seriously, they just show up differently. And my kids are still really young. And so we'll see how that evolves. But that's maybe like the one thread that I would tie it all back to.
Yeah, Ryan kind of stole my thought, but just to...
just he has to actual that, children, from... so his thoughts do actually on this topic matter the most.
Exactly. I don't have any firsthand experience, but when starting to think about Primer and looking generally at the space of like education, parenting, all of that, I talked to a bunch of people where they had multiple siblings, and all of the siblings are successful by like all kinds of metrics. And I was trying to suss out what is the common thread among their parents? What did their parents do? You see this a lot actually in Silicon Valley, like the Collison brothers, there are quite a few like siblings where everyone is extremely successful. And it's really interesting to look at like what is the common theme among the parents? What did they do? And the one thing that stood out to me, which is related to taking it seriously, is the fact that their parents gave them all real responsibilities really early on. And that's basically the idea of like, take the kids seriously. So don't try to like, kind of like create too many cushions or whatever around them. Give them real responsibility where there are real implications. If things don't work out, real implications. If things do work out, obviously, still within certain borders. But similar to Ryan, I think it all ties back to taking kids seriously. And there are like many, many dimensions to it. But I would say just that. You can probably write an entire book on just that. Taking kids seriously, because there are so many facets.
Yeah, if anyone wants to check out, learn more about Primer, you can go to primer.com or at Primer on Twitter or Instagram. Yeah, if you reach out to me, I'm at Delk on Twitter. DMs are open. Always happy to chat, answer questions.
Thanks for joining us in the Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.